Okay, everybody's in and the recording is set. Over to you, Francis.
Hey everyone. So some people got the information that this webinar starts at in 30 minutes from now, and then others got the information that it starts now. So we could expect a few joining us in 28 minutes or so. It's always a challenge to get these times lined up between the constant contact notices and the calendar on Moria Federation, so people respond to those two different sources. But we got a dozen people here now, so we'll go ahead and start. So this is our 98th webinar. And we've started this great new book, Sylvia Cranston's HPB's The Extraordinary Life and Influence of Helena Blavatsky. This reading is today is just super, in my opinion. So if we could get a reader to start us off.
I'll start us off. Hi,
Great.
everybody. For Helena, all nature seemed animated with a mysterious life of its own, Vera relates. She heard the voice of every object and form, whether organic or inorganic, and claimed consciousness in being, not only for some mysterious powers visible and audible to herself alone, in what was to everyone else empty space, but even for visible but inanimate things such as pebbles, molds, and pieces of decaying phosphorescent timber. It may be owing to such experiences that Helena was drawn to a centurion by the name of Berenice, or yeah, him, Boyeric, who dwelt close to Saratov. He was revered by the people in that area as a holy person, a healer, and a magician. His house was in a wild ravine of a neighboring forest. He was greatly versed in the knowledge of the occult properties of plants and flowers, reports Vera, and could read the future, it is said. Boyeric had an irresistible attraction for Helena, Vera continues. She visited the strange old man whenever she could. Once there, she would put questions and listen with a passionate earnestness to the old man's replies and explanations as how to understand the language of bees, birds, and animals. He used to say to her constantly to us, "This little lady is quite different from all of you. There are great events lying in wait for her in the future. I feel sorry in thinking that I will not live to see my predictions of her verified, but they will all come to pass."
I could be Al, next reader.
Scott, can you read that, please?
Yes. All right. A wise personage of another order than Boryrak, it seems, was interested in Helena's welfare. From her earliest recollections, Sinnett remarks, she would sometimes have visions of a mature protector whose imposing appearance dominated her imagination from a very early period. This protector was always the same. His features never changed. In later life, she met him as a living man and knew him as though she had been present, as she had been brought up in his presence. There is no indication that Helena spoke to her family about this personage, but Vera says that as a girl, Helena would say, "Wise men have existed in all ages and existed even in our days, making themselves known only to those who are worthy of knowing and seeing them, and who believed in instead of laughing at them." It may be that to her so-called protector, she owed her invulnerability to harm. If such examples that follow, retold by Sinnett, are to be credited. The first occurred in the family gallery that housed the portraits of the Dogorla Revko, ancestors. One picture excited Helena's curiosity. It was covered by a curtain and placed high on the wall, out of reach. Her relatives refused to say who it was, so Helena stole into the room one day when no one else was around.
Thank you, Scott. Next.
Vivian.
In Sinnett's words, she dragged a table to the wall and contrived to set another small table on that and a chair on the top of all, and then gradually succeeded in mounting up on this unstable edifice. She could just manage to reach the picture, and leaning with one hand against the dusty wall, contrived with the other to draw back the curtain. The effect wrought upon her by the sight of the picture was startling, and the momentary movement back upset her frail platform. But exactly what occurred, she does not know. She lost consciousness from the moment she staggered and began to fall. And when she recovered her senses, she was lying quite unhurt on the floor. The tables and chair were back again in their usual places. The curtain had been run back upon its rings, and she would have imagined the whole incident some unusual kind of dream, but for the fact that the mark on her small hand remained imprinted on the dusty wall high up beside the picture.
Thank you, Vivian. Give some insight into the extraordinary being who DK dedicated the entire treatise on cosmic fire to, that we're working with in this webinar series. Okay, so our last session started with a discussion on why Jehovah cannot be the quote-unquote one true God, that abstraction called by HPB the absolute, or even the first manifested logos. The reason being that he is described in Genesis as a creator God, an aspect of Brahma, and thus more akin to Bina, the feminine third Sephiroth. After a phrase-by-phrase analysis of verse 2, we finished the section on that verse and began our study of verse 3, which reads, "When the one became two, the threefold appears. The three are linked into one, and it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant called Saptaparna." HPB then begins her analysis with, "When the one eternal drops its reflection into the region of manifestation, that reflection, the quote-unquote ray, differentiates the water of space. This differentiation is the cosmic sun born of the one father and mother or matter." We then compare this verse, which is verse 3 of stanza 7, with verse 3 of the third stanza, which details the same 1 to 2 to 3 descent into matter, you know, father, mother, son. But instead of resulting in the Saptaparna, or man plant, in our solar system, the earlier verse ends with condensation of the world A, which is the entire universe. Next, we took a look at how the 1 to 2 to 3 descent was described in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Quote, "Chaos ceases through the effulgence of the ray of primordial light, dissipating total darkness by the help of the great magic power of the word of the central sun." This particular version of the descent is personified by the gods Ptah, Ta, Osiris, and Ra. HPB then describes the nature of Ra, quote, The Egyptian Ra issuing from the deep is the divine universal soul in its manifested aspect. The Purusha, concealed in Akasha and present in ether. So when chaos becomes male-female, Ra, the divine universal soul, the product of father-mother, in its manifested aspect, issues forth. He is the life force that then animates the limbs of Brahma or Deva builders. So you can see how closely the Egyptian version of the ageless wisdom corresponds with other versions, including the Hindu and theosophical ideas. As to the phrase, the Purusha concealed in Akasha and present in ether. So Akasha is the primordial spiritual substance in its pure hidden state. The spirit, Purusha, is concealed here because Akasha, as the root or cause of the material world, is too abstract to perceive, to be perceived by all but high initiates. Ether, on the other hand, is the lower, grosser reflection of Akasha. The spirit is present here because ether is the active agent or vehicle through which the creative forces like light, sound, and electricity operate in our visible universe. HPB then moves into a discussion of the rounds. So a quick review of the purpose of a round in relation to the 1 to 2 to 3 line of descent that we've been studying. In this context, a round is the specific mechanism by which the one, in this case the monad, becomes the two, which is spirit and matter. By cycling through a series of rounds, monads sequentially incarnate into progressively denser globes before eventually ascending as a realized threefold conscious entity, that third aspect being consciousness. Thus, rounds serve as the quote-unquote cycle of necessity, a mandatory process that compels spirit to merge with matter in order to generate consciousness. You know, coincidentally, we're studying the exact same concept in a treatise on cosmic fire. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So we'll start this section with a continuation of HPB's review of this concept of the round. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, and Veronica, can you read that for us, please? I don't see you unmuting, and Veronica.
Yes, yes.
There you go. There you go.
Okay. Now, every round on the descending scale is but a repetition in a more concrete form of the round which preceded it, as every globe down to our fourth sphere, the actual Earth, is a grosser and a more material copy of the more shadowy sphere which preceded it in their successive order on the three higher planes. See diagram in stanza 6. On its way upwards on the ascending arc, evolution spiritualizes and etherealizes, so to speak, the general nature of all, bringing it onto the level with the plane on which the twin globe of the opposite side is placed. The result being that when the seventh globe is reached, in whatever round, the nature of everything that is evolving returns to the condition it was in at its starting point, plus every time a new and superior degree in the states of consciousness. Thus, it becomes clear that the origin of man, so-called on this our present round, or life cycle on this planet, must occupy the same place in the same order, save details based on location, condition, and time, as in the preceding round.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. Okay, first, now Every round on the descending scale is but a repetition in a more concrete form of the round which preceded it, as every globe down to our fourth sphere, the actual Earth, is a grosser and more material copy of the more shadowy sphere which precedes it in their successive order on the three higher planes. See diagram in stanza 6, commentary number 6. So this material was introduced in much more detail in the Sacred Doctrine earlier, about 50 pages ago. But it never hurts to refresh our memories on this. Also, I encourage you to ask any questions or make any comments you have about this. It's a difficult subject to master, this idea of rounds, globes, chains, you know, root races, schemes, that whole series of ideas, interrelated ideas. So, you know, if you don't understand something, now's a good time to ask about it. So here's the chart of the seven rounds of a chain, but I've also added the root races of each globe, which is the tiny little numbers that are around the circumference of each globe. So we have here the entire scheme indicated. The only thing that's not shown is that there's actually seven passages through each of these chains as we move through. So you would have seven passages, those are the rounds, through the first chain, and then seven passages around the second chain, etc., all the way around. So you really have seven times the map you're seeing here progressively. So you can see what an extraordinary process this a scheme embodies. So between the first and fourth rounds, every round of seven globes, which are these larger circles lettered A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, becomes more concrete than during the round before it. Okay. On the involutional cycle until the fourth round is reached, which is where we are now. Same is true of every globe within each round. For instance, we're down here in this fourth round. Every globe is progressively denser as we move and involutionally until you get to the fourth globe, which is where we are currently. Here's the reference diagram, you know, which he says, see your diagram in stanza 6. This is that diagram which shows the planets. You know, these parallel lines are meant to show density. So you have 1, 2, 3, our dense Earth, and then back up 5, 6, and 7, which interestingly are higher etherically than the 1, 2, 3 going down. Many charts don't show that nuance. On the right, we see the sense of globe 1, 2, 4 in density, which parallels, but with some differences, the descent of the human principles from spirit to the physical body. But there is a definite relationship between how the planets descend into matter and how the human principles move into matter. Yes, Nadell.
I think this is relevant here. One thing that's not clear to me is, I know it was said earlier that the human kingdom came before the animal kingdom. It has something to do with the reshes or something. I'm not quite clear on, I guess, this whole idea of humanity in some sense sort of being the progenitor of the animal kingdom, if you understand what I'm asking.
Yeah. So the first is actually the globe itself, which is made up of the mineral kingdom. So that's the life wave that is associated with the mineral kingdom comes first. Let's go back to this slide here. So we're talking about this, any one of these globes that are shown here. So the life wave of the mineral kingdom comes in, and this is detailed back on, I think it's about page 170, she really talks about this transference of the life wave, and the first to come is the mineral. Then there are a sequential series of monadic levels that incarnate, whose life wave transfers to a given globe, right? And it prepares in some way that's not described the environment, vibrational environment of that globe for the appearance, the subsequent appearance of the monads of later life waves. After that initial life wave comes the animal and plant waves. Now, I'm trying to remember if she gives a reason for why this is the case. Why do human monads precede the animal and plant? But it does have to do with the fact that they prepare the ground, vibrationally prepare the environment so that it can sustain the life of the lower kingdoms. You know, it's always, the teaching is always that the human kingdom is a shepherd over the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms. So in the creation, the human wave comes first, except for the mineral wave, which literally provides the structure for the human wave to then incarnate on. Of course, it's completely, it's beyond etheric. It's really fiery in those initial manifestations. And by the time the human being enters a dense physical body, the plant and animal kingdom are well in process. That's what I remember. We would have to go back to that. There was an interim section in the Secret Doctrine that we spent many months on, between two stanzas. And she develops this whole theme to a much greater extent than she is currently developing it. So that's what I remember. Anyone else? Any other thoughts?
Nope, that's it for now.
Okay, let's see where we were. Oh yeah, we were doing this. Okay, so next, on its way upwards on the ascending arc, evolution spiritualizes and etherealizes, so to speak, the general nature of all, bringing it on to a level with the plane on which the twin globe on the opposite side is placed. The result being that when the seventh globe is reached in whatever round, the nature of everything that is evolving returns to the condition it was in at its starting point. Plus, every time, a new and superior degree of in the states of consciousness. So from the fifth root race of globe D, which is where we are now, our current root race, up through the most etherealized globe of the seventh round, we will be on the evolutionary arc, during which time, quote, evolution spiritualizes and etherealizes, so to speak, the general nature of all. With each ascending round, a parallel stage of ethereality is reached with an earlier involutionary rounds. So as we move forward on the evolutionary rounds, the fifth will be at the same stage of material etherealization, which is described as water. It's not anything like the water that exists on the dense earth, but it's the equivalent, a more etherealized stage of the element. So you have a linking just at material levels of the third and fifth, and then again at the sixth and the second, and finally at the seventh and first, all sharing a similar elemental reality. Now, if you remember going back here, the chart shown in the Secret Doctrine shows a distinctly higher level, but within the same brackets that determine the actual element here, you know. So you would have, for instance, water, air, ether, but the seventh would be of the highest levels of ether, and the sixth of the highest airy levels, five the highest watery levels. But that's, the teaching is only given in this actual visuals of this particular chart. I haven't read anything that corresponds to that teaching. Anyway, see, let's get back up here. Boom, boom. Oh, importantly though, huge difference is the progressive evolution of consciousness. So this is seventh chain, even though it shares the same ethereality, is the fully developed consciousness aspect, and the root races that participate in this chain and round. The rounds of this chain is what I should be saying.
Francis?
Right? Yeah.
Ariane asks, why is Uranus not included? Is it merely a catalyst? And what about the 73 unperceived planet?
What was that last one? What about the seven?
The 73 unperceived planets. You know, DK tells us.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, there's actually, he says there's 115 planets are involved in the system, most of them ethereal. Yeah, well, the rulers of this are actually given in a series of charts that are published in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. The rulers of the chain, for instance, the second chain is called the Venus chain. The second globe is called the Venus globe. I can't tell you why Uranus isn't a chain ruler. It's one of the, let's see here. Neptune, however, is included here. So yeah, I can't really answer your question on that. And there's almost no information. This is one of those answers where I'm not able to really answer you. There's almost no information about those, about the unlisted, referenced, but not listed planets. You know, lately some of the Pluto-sized planets beyond the periphery, beyond the orbit of Pluto, have really come to the fore in astrology, and I would think that those certainly are part of that 115. And more information is being brought in by intuitive astrologers about those planets. But that's still there's and even if you include prominent asteroids, there's still many, many more ethereal planets that aren't mentioned or described at all. And in terms of what you said, what about them? Well, it makes sense that they wouldn't be rulers of any of the chains in the Earth's game because they aren't part of that grouping associated with this line of becoming. But again, I can't really say why not Uranus in this sense, except for that it's the ultimate synthesizing planet, and so in many ways it would possibly represent a stage beyond this. You could say that, in the Preliac chains, there's in some charts there are three chains that stand above the manifested line, which are entered and gone through during Prelia. Some branches of theosophy teach this, others don't. It might be more related to that. I saw your hand flash up, Ariane. What do you have?
Yeah. Oh gosh. So is it scheme, chains, globes, rounds? Is that the order?
Okay. Scheme, chains, globes. No. Scheme, chains, globes is there's two interleaved qualities of experience here. You could say that the material quality is for a given planet a scheme, which includes in the next line down seven chains, right? Excuse me. Each chain containing seven globes, each of those globes containing seven root races. So that's the schema from, scheme, chain, globe, root race, and each of them being septenary in relation to the other. Well, I didn't mention round in that because round is a is the introduce introduction of the concept of time to a chain. So a chain is made up of seven planets. A round is one of the seven times that those seven planets are revisited by the life waves that occupy these planets. So they're not really in the same hierarchical structure as schemes, chains, and globes, but are rather how these chains and globes respond to time, or how they unfold over time.
Yeah, so can I ask about that? I have, and then I have a question, and then I have a comment. So what about reincarnation of planets? Like, is that part of this? And where does that come in?
Okay, reincarnation of a planet happens when the life wave transfers from any one of the planets. The example often given is the globe D. Here, let me get to where it's lit up here. Okay. Here. Okay. So the transfer of globe D, which is our actual moon, which was the D globe of the moon, alternately called Saturn, chain. Okay. The transfer of the life wave to our current globe, which is the Earth, which is the globe D of the Earth chain. That's the way these transfers work of life work. And that would be the reincarnation of a planet, because unlike See, these seven globes of each chain coexist. They're on different levels of ethereality, and they become active when the life wave moves to them. So they're not incarnations of each other. They are independent existence. The transference of the life wave would be what one might call a reincarnation of the planet. So globe D to globe D of the next chain, C to C of the next chain, etc. Right, and these are progressive, right?
Are you saying that we're getting these things from the Neptune, Venus, Saturn, Earth are feeding the globes of our planet? They're not coming. They're not independent.
No, the rulerships have to do with quality. They're not. In other words, the Venus chain is not Venus. It's Venus's influence, rulership over the second chain, right? This is where Sanat Kumara came in. You know, he came in through the second globe, which is the Venus globe of the second chain, the Venus globe, and transferred to the Venus globe, the second globe of the Earth chain, and then from there transferred to the fourth globe of the Earth chain. So that's just an example of how that works. Now, his connection with Venus has been made very clear, you know, in the teachings. And so but this has to do with a qualitative overshadowing. It's not the literal, the second chain is not the literal planet Venus in any way.
And what about Earth? Is this just the quality of Earth? It's not actually.
Yeah, it's the density, the nature of the density of the third ray aspect of the Earth's personality, second soul quality, all of that. You know, first ray monad, second ray soul, and third ray personality, which rules the entire Earth chain. And then that's even more pronounced on globe D, because Earth, the D, you know, is the same position, the fourth in line, and therefore is also ruled by the Earth. So you have that quality magnified, the Earth's rulership, as well as its ray aspects, you know, on the globe. So, you know, there's a sub-rulership on each of these. You know, for instance, the Venus rules not only the entire second chain, but also the second globe of that chain. Saturn rules the third globe of the Venus chain. You see how that works? So each of these rulerships can also be applied to the planets, right?
You know what it reminds me of? I don't know if anyone, there's this fantastic book called, I think in English it's called Dialogues with Angels. And so they show the human being in the middle of the menorah. So there's like the human being has a function between the, you know, the mineral and, you know, the different kingdoms are on the left, you know, vegetable, mineral, vegetable, animal. And then the human kingdom at the center, is like a bridge between the angelic
the higher kingdoms.
Yeah, the higher kingdoms. And so this, maybe all the planets have this. You know, this is just our Earth version, but it feels like it's so analogous to what the, you know, the function that the human beings are also like a conduit to help channel other planetary energies to this planet so that the lower kingdoms can evolve, like I mentioned earlier in the other time we met, where the different body types attract and magnetize different planetary energies. And so that seems to be, so every planet would have one of these drawings, right?
Yeah, certainly. Good luck finding it, but yeah, you know, every planet is a scheme. Now there would be you know, the general teaching is that there's seven chains, seven globes, seven root races on each. And there's even seven schemes, and then three synthesizing schemes, making a total of 10 schemes. But there's, in late in TCF, he talks about how certain chains and globes are truncated, and it becomes less, you know, like you'll have five globes to complete a chain or five rounds to complete a chain. So it's not set in stone, but the general rule is the septenary nature of all the component parts. Okay, next up. On its way upward on the ascending arc. I did this one, didn't I? Let me see if I did. Yeah, I did. Okay. Moving right along. Yeah, we went through this. All right. So, again, this is a really good time to raise your hand if you don't understand any component of what we're talking about here. Because it's a kind of basic review. And it's an important thing to understand how the system works. Okay. So finally we have, thus it becomes clear that the origin of man, so-called, on this, our present round or life cycle on this planet, must occupy the same place in the same order, save details based on local conditions and time, as the preceding round. So first of all, HPB uses the qualifier so-called origin of man, because in theosophy, man, who is the monad, is eternal. Thus, he does not have any kind of absolute origin, or, you know, specific origin, but rather reappears in new progressively higher grades of matter at the start of each new cycle. So, but based on, you know, if we take that caveat into mind, here's how what she's saying works. The most advanced class of monad arrives on each globe first, in order to establish, of course, the globe has to be constituted, and that's a function of the mineral kingdom. After that, humanity arrives first, the most advanced class of monad arrives first, in order to establish the vibrational field that allows for the next level of monads to appear. This is cyclically identical to the appearance of these same monads in each previous round, right? So for example, the same group of monads who first appear on globe A of round three to establish that globe's first root race also later appear on globe A of round four to establish its first root race. This is called the transference of the life wave. Okay. Any thoughts or questions? All right, next up. Again, oh no, we need a reader here.
Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Again, it must be explained and remembered that as the work of each round is said to be apportioned to a different group of so-called creators or architects, so is that of every globe. That is, it is under the supervision and guidance of special builders and watchers, the various Dayan Chohans. The group of the hierarchy, which is commissioned to create men, is a special group, then. Yet it involved shadowy man in this cycle, just as a higher and still more spiritual group evolved him in the third round. But as it is the sixth on the downward scale of spirituality, the last, and seventh being the terrestrial spirits, elementals, which gradually form, build, and condense his physical body. This sixth group evolves no more than the future man's shadowy form, a filmy, hardly visible, transparent copy of themselves. It becomes the task of the fifth hierarchy, the mysterious beings that preside over the constellation Capricornus, Makara, or Crocodile in India, as in Egypt, to inform the empty and ethereal animal form and make of it the rational man.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, first, again, it must be explained and remembered that as the work of each round is said to be apportioned to a different group of so-called creators or architects, so is that of every globe. That is, it is under the supervision and guidance of special builders and watchers, the various Dian Chohans. So this is new information. Just as a construction site has electricians, plumbers, framers, etc., who come in at specific stages, cosmic evolution has specific hierarchies of Dian Chohans assigned to specific tasks and time periods. Thus, the intelligences that designed the ethereal first round are totally different from those overseeing the dense fourth round. Also, there are many different grades within the ranks of the Dian Chohans, from the architects who provide the ideation or blueprints for a round, you know, great Deva lords, down to the builders who execute the plan. And finally, the teeny elemental lives who still belong to the David kingdom that use their own bodies to build the form world. Next. The group of the hierarchy which is commissioned to create men is a special group then. Yet it evolved shadowy man in this cycle, just as a higher and still more spiritual group evolved him in the third round. So this special group is made up of lunar Petries, also called Barhishad Petries. Though the consciousness aspect was less developed in the third round, matter was more ethereal. Thus, the lunar Petries of that round were quote, higher and still more spiritual from a material perspective. The same thing could be said when comparing the Lemurian to the Aryan root races. Though our fifth root race has a vastly more developed consciousness, the matter of the early Lemurian root race was more ethereal and thus of a higher vibration. You get this? Even though it was less evolved in terms of consciousness, it participated in a more spiritualized form of matter. Okay, next up. But this is a bit convoluted. But as it is the sixth on the downward scale of spirituality, the last and seventh being the terrestrial spirits, elementals, which gradually form, build, and condense his physical body, this sixth group evolves no more than the future man's shadowy form, a filmy, hardly visible, transparent copy of themselves. Well, I would imagine it's hardly visible to HPB and invisible to most. So this references the scale from the first to the seventh level of Dian Chohans, responsible for constructing humanity's physical vehicles, right? The sixth group, which he's referencing here, can't create the physical body because they are astral beings. They can only provide what they possess, their own astral double, a transparent copy of themselves called the Chaya or Linga Sharira. Once the lunar Petries project this shadowy form, the seventh group, called the Earth Elements, use their own bodies to replicate that form on the physical plane. Okay, I saw your hand, Ariane.
I'm so lost, I'm so sorry. But first of all, I don't understand why you showed that picture, what that picture actually illustrates. That would be the first question.
Okay, well, it's a picture of these Bahishads, also called Chahayas, and they're beings, David beings, who are capable of building the human form, but not of overshadowing that form or providing that form with the spark of mind. So they're very active in the first 2.5 root races, where the whole process is about form building and form perfecting, right? They're still responsible for building our physical forms. But in addition to their work, we also have the Manasaputras, the overshadowing solar angels, who then implant the spark of mind in these forms, and therefore, by doing so, create the fourth kingdom in nature, rather than just animal man, which is the highest that such beings are able to create. Does that make sense?
So there's these two kinds of influxes. There's like the planets, or the, I hope I'm not incorrect, the globes are becoming more concrete, more physical, but eventually they go back to the ethereal after the fourth round or whatever. I'm not sure if that's the right word to be using. So they start from the ethereal, then they go to the physical. They go, I guess it's a chain. I'm so sorry.
Rounds. All of it, you know, they move into density, and the move towards the ethereal applies to globes, chains, and rounds.
And so there's like these two forces. There's the force of involution, where it becomes increasingly physical, and then it's returned to the evolutionary cycle. But it just seems so. So this is like about the birth of solar systems, the birth of planets, the birth of universes. This is basically the trajectory of life everywhere in the universe, that it starts from the ethereal, goes denser involutionary arc, and then goes to something more ethereal. Is that what he's demonstrating here?
It would seem to be a universal law, but you know, even the highest Chohans in this solar system are unable to determine whether, for instance, these laws apply, you know, to our galaxy, or you know, even to the Pleiades or the Great Bear. You know, we can assume they're universal laws. You know, there are references that Sirius, that the same septenary system is in play on Sirius, and so we have that confirmation. So we may assume that it is indeed a universal law of how each level, because remember, there's seven schemes in a solar system, so we can assume that solar logoi undergo a similar, but also different and detailed process of becoming. So yes, it's a template that is universally applicable. Got me get back up here. Yeah, so we were looking at this. Okay. No, we're not that far. Oh yeah, that's where we were. All right, so we're talking about the sixth and the fact that the seventh group comes in and replicates the form created by the sixth on the physical plane. And finally we have, it becomes a task of the fifth hierarchy, the mysterious beings that preside over the constellation Capricornus Macara or Crocodile in India, as in Egypt, to inform the empty and ethereal animal form and make of it the rational man. This is the birth of the soul being described here. The beings that preside over the constellation Capricornus, interesting that word preside over, are the solar angels, also called Agnishvatas, Manasaputras, sons of mind, who provide the spark of mind to humanity. Before this overshadowing, man is a quote-unquote empty, meaning he was not yet a thinking indweller. But the forms had been perfected by these Barhishads, these lunar beings, so that it was capable of receiving the spark of mind. So two very distinct groups, lunar and solar in nature, okay? The footnote referenced by the phrase, the group of, I'm gonna catch Barbara's hand first. Go ahead, Barbara.
Apparently, during the pralaya, the life force actually creates new blueprints that carry forward, that make possible the next rounds. So there's the life force. It is actually helping evolution. So during the rounds, is there additional help for evolution? Humanity has some responsibility for this, for enhancing soul power. But are there sort of between rounds a kind of upscaling of the soul as there is during the pralaya?
Well, that's also my opinion. You know, there's really nothing written. The only thing given is by, there are some theosophical charts that show inner rounds, which happened during the pralayic period. But in some ways, that's it's a contradiction, because the whole concept of pralaya is a kind of Devi with us, where one is immersed in spirit, you know. But since it's a conditional pralaya, not a universal pralaya, I'm of the opinion that indeed new blueprints are formulated, and there is, through infusion of spirit, and that spirit is in consonance with the coming round. In other words, the pralaya shifts the nature of the spirit function from its purpose in the previous round to that of the coming round, right? And so, yeah, I'm of the opinion that, you know, when that life wave goes forth in that new round, that there's a significant uptick in the vibrational influence of spirit in that new round. And then your other part of your question was, you know, does humanity have a responsibility in this process? And the answer is absolutely. You know, there's this basic, you know, you've been in these Treatise on Cosmic Fire webinars, and we're talking about this right now, the question of why is there duality? You know, it's this third question that we're working on in TCF, you know. And it's basically spirit and matter are a polarity that creates consciousness. And part of that consciousness, which is the second aspect, is the continuous upgrading of new forms that are an amalgam of higher grade material for the indweller to occupy, right? And that comes through the evolutionary process of the indweller. So, you know, the indweller, through his or her work on the path of return, actually builds into the permanent atoms a higher grade of material, which then is drawn from to make new forms that then allow for even higher potential. So that's ongoing during the whole process, in a kind of counterintuitive way. Even on the evolutionary scale, it's all evolution. It's just that the focus is initially on building the proper vehicle, a vehicle that can withstand the impress of soul or the implanting of the spark of mind, right? And then on the upswing, starting in the middle of the third root race, at least on Globe D, the influence of the Manasaputra dominates the entire process, and forms become sequentially more etherealized, are made of a higher grade of substance. So yeah, two things going on at once: this quality of the spirit aspect during pralaya. You know, for instance, the planetary logos on a planetary pralaya would be, and the chain lord and the globe lords would all be participating in this transference of and upscaling of the quality that would then be represented by the next cycle. Okay, does that answer your question?
A fantastic answer, and just one follow-up question.
Yeah.
Are the initial visionaries trying out the new vibrations? Are they in some way even preparing the earth with the new vibrations?
Okay, I missed your noun. Are the initial what?
You said that there's a group that comes into the first round first that has.
I see. Yeah, that first wave of the most evolved monads,
uh-huh.
Right? That condition. Yeah, they condition the environment so that the second round of monads can eventually come in.
Yeah.
Was that your question? Yeah. Okay. Right. I'd have to go, you know, it makes me want to reread, you know, I'm always tempted to just bring everybody with me right now and go back to page 170-ish where this is described in detail and review that. But yeah, in general, that's how it works, that you have this highest grade of monads that initiates the vibration on the new and conditions the globe for all subsequent life waves, including the lower kingdoms in nature and the lesser monadic waves. Okay, let's see here. So the footnote referenced by the phrase, the group of the hierarchy which is commissioned to create men states Creation is an incorrect word to use. There's no religion, not even the sect of the Vishishta Advaitis in India, one which anthropomorphizes even Parabrahm, believes in creation out of nihil, as Christians and Jews do, but in evolution out of pre-existing materials. Okay, here HBB is attacking the Judeo-Christian idea that God, you know, snaps his fingers, creates the universe out of nothingness by a mere act of will or speech. In occultism, something cannot be produced from nothing. HPB chooses the Vishishta Advaita school of Vedanta because that school is the most theistic of the Vedantic schools. They view Brahman personally and believe that he possesses the qualities unlike the abstract absolute of the Vaita. Basically, HPB is saying, look, even the Hindu sect that is most like Western monotheism still refuses to believe in creation out of nothing, you know, therefore underscoring the error of the Christian and Jewish faiths for putting forth that doctrine. Okay, next up, could we get a reader?
Sure. Tom? Can you read that for us, please?
It is one of those subjects upon which very little may be said to the general public. It is a mystery, truly, but only to him who is prepared to reject the existence of intellectual and conscious spiritual beings in the universe, limiting full consciousness to man alone, and that only as a function of the brain. Many are those among the spiritual entities who have incarnated bodily man since the beginning of his appearance, and who, for all that, still exist as independently as they did before in the infinitudes of space. To put it more clearly, the invisible entity may be bodily present on Earth without abandoning, however, its status and functions in the supersensuous regions. If this needs explanation, we can do no better than remind the reader of like cases in spiritualism, though such cases are very rare, at least as regards the nature of the entity incarnating or taking temporary possession of a medium. The so-called spirits that may occasionally possess themselves of the bodies of mediums are not the monads of higher principles of disembodied personalities. Such a spirit can only be either an elementary or a nirmanakaya.
Oops, didn't unmute. Okay, thank you, Tom. Okay, so first, this is one of those subjects upon which very little may be said to the general public. It is a mystery, truly, but only to him who is prepared to reject the existence of intellectual and conscious spiritual beings in the universe, limiting full consciousness to man alone, and that only as a, quote, function of the brain. So HPB here argues that the difficulty in understanding the Manasaputras comes from the fact that modern science starts with the false premise that consciousness is a function of brain activity because it cannot compass the idea of non-corporeal intelligence. Next. Many are those among the spiritual entities who have incarnated bodily in man since the beginning of his appearance, and who, for all that, still exist independently as they did before in the infinitudes of space. So a prime example of this is the soul on its own plane, who projects a fragment of itself into incarnation, which becomes the imprisoned spark of mind, also called the human soul, that yearns for reunion with the solar angel who sent it forth, and who overshadows the personality while remaining on its own sphere. It is this indwelling spark that eventually compels the personality to tread the path of return. It's like the sun shining on a lake. The sun remains undiminished in the sky, while at the same time making possible life within the lake without actually having to bodily descend into that lake. Next. To put it more clearly, the invisible entity may be bodily present on Earth without abandoning, however, its status and function in the supersensuous regions. If this needs explanation, we can do no better than remind the reader of like cases in spiritualism, though such cases are very rare, at least as regards the nature of the entity incarnating. So once more, a soul's influence during incarnation is not a transfer of location, but an extension of its consciousness into the lower quaternary. The quote, like cases in spiritualism, refers to spirit guides in a seance, which were very popular in HPB's time, who can take possession of a medium's body, speak through their mouth, and even use their hands without actually becoming the medium. Let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the phrase, the nature of the entity incarnating. Quote, the so-called spirits that may occasionally possess themselves of the bodies of mediums are not the monads or higher principles of disembodied personalities. Such a spirit can only be either an elementary or a nirmanakaya. An important point for anyone considering attending a seance. The beings there contacted are not the souls, let alone the monads of the departed, but are rather a shell composed of the deceased's old passions, desires, and memories, which have been galvanized into a kind of false life that HPB here calls an elementary. It has no conscience and no intelligence of its own, kind of like a parrot repeating old phrases. I think HPB only mentions the other option, a nirmanakaya, because she worked with a group of these disembodied high adepts while writing her great works, including Dual Cool. Such high beings would never appear at a seance conducted by a mere medium. Okay? Any thoughts or questions? Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Nadel, can you read that for us, please? Nadel? Oh, there you are.
Just as certain persons, men and women, reverting to parallel cases among living persons, whether by virtue of a peculiar organization or through the power of acquired mystic knowledge can be seen in their double in one place while the body is many miles away. So the same thing can occur in the case of superior beings. Man, philosophically considered, is, in his outward form, simply an animal, hardly more perfect than his pithecoid-like ancestor of the third round. He is a living body, not a living being, since the realization of existence, the ego sum, necessitates self-consciousness, and an animal can only have direct consciousness or instinct. This was so well understood by the ancients that the Kabbalists even made of soul and body two lives, independent of each other. The soul, whose body vehicle is the astral, ethereal, substantial envelope, can die and man be still living on earth. That is, the soul could free itself from and quit the tabernacle for various reasons, such as insanity, spiritual and physical depravity, etc.
Thank you, Nadell. First, just as certain persons, men and women, reverting to parallel cases among living persons, whether by virtue of a peculiar organization or through the power of acquired mystic knowledge, can be seen in their quote-unquote double in one place, while the body is many miles away, so the same thing can occur in the case of superior beings. So here HPB moves from the analogy of spiritualism to the analogy of living projection or active bilocation to further demystify how the solar angels operate. In the book, The Miracle of Love by Ram Dass, there are a number of stories narrated by different followers about their guru, Neem Karoli Baba, appearing in two places at once. The narrative would go something like this. A follower would say, oh, we had a wonderful time with the guru at such and such a temple. Then another follower would break in and say, but that's impossible. I spent the whole day with him in such and such person's house, right? And this was not one instance. This book is riddled with such stories. So very clearly, this extraordinary being named Karoli Baba was a master at what HPB here calls bilocation, right? Being at two places at once. So it's just another example of how this phenomenon of you know, you can either be on the higher and lower plane at the same time, or even on the same plane, functioning in two bodies, seemingly. Next, man, philosophically considered, is in his outward form simply an animal, hardly more perfect than his pithecoid-like ancestor of the third round. He is a living body, not a living being, since the realization of existence, the ego sum, necessitates self-consciousness, and an animal can only have direct consciousness or instinct. So HPB here suggests that the human form is pretty much like it was at the height of its development by the lunar petries, right, the Barkhishans, who were responsible for building the form aspect during Lemurian times. They could only build what they knew, a high-grade animal form. Quote, he is a living body means that the machine works, right? The heart beats, the nerves fire, the stomach digests, et cetera, et cetera. And it is capable of receiving and exuding prana. A living being, as opposed to a living body, is the, what she calls here, the ego sum principle, Latin for I am, which references that great initiation called individualization carried out by the Manasaputras. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this distinction between these two types?
It's not about the distinction, but Ariane says Neem Karoli Baba could drive within a physical car through other cars. He was said to be 250 years old when Ram Dass or Richard Albert encountered him.
Yeah, it's one of the extraordinary stories. You know, if you want to be immensely entertained and at the same time spiritually learn a lot about spiritual phenomena, I really recommend The Miracle of Love. It's just a phenomenal book. Okay. Finally, this was so well understood by the ancients, the fact that there's these two components, that the Kabbalists even made of soul and body two lives, independent of each other. The soul, whose body vehicle is the astral ethero-substantial envelope could die and man be still living on Earth. That is, the soul could free itself from and quit the tabernacle for various reasons, such as insanity, spiritual and physical depravity, etc. So HBB here suggests that a human being is actually running two distinct operating systems simultaneously, an animal life consisting of prana, instinctual mind, and the functioning of the heart, lungs, etc., and a soul life made up of a person's conscious, moral, and intellectual vitality. But her point here is that because they are two different systems, one system can withdraw while the other keeps running, resulting in a soulless person who can still walk, talk, eat, and sleep. They may even possess a high degree of cunning intellect. However, they will always lack compassion and a conscience, both of which comes from the ego. These soulless types were mentioned a number of times in the readings by Edgar Cayce. He even identified people in a client's family or work life that were soulless. But he also said they were only about 1 in 1,000 cases. So let's take a look at the footnotes. First up, the footnote referenced by the phrase, soul and body, two lives independent of each other. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes, Michelle. Can you read that for us, please?
On page 340 to 351, Genesis of the Soul, in the New Aspects of Life, the author states the Kabbalistic teaching. They held that, functionally, spirit and matter of corresponding opacity and density tended to coalesce, and that the resultant created spirits in the disembodied state were constituted on a scale of which the differing opacities and transparencies of elemental or uncreated spirit were reproduced, and that these spirits in the disembodied state attracted, appropriated, and digested and assimilated elemental spirit and elemental matter whose condition was conformed to their own. They therefore taught that there was a wide difference in the condition of created spirits, and that in the intimate association between the spirit world and the world of matter, the more opaque spirits in the disembodied state were drawn towards the more dense parts of the material world, and therefore tended towards the center of the earth, where they found the conditions most suited to their state, while the more transparent spirits passed into the surrounding aura of the planet, the most rarefied finding their home in its satellite.
Thank you, Michelle. Okay, first, in Genesis of the Soul and the New Aspects of Life, the author states, the Kabbalistic teaching, they held that functionally, spirit and matter of corresponding opacity, that's the key phrase, and density tended to coalesce, and that the resultant created spirits in the disembodied state were constituted on a scale in which the differing opacities and transparencies of elemental or uncreated spirit were reproduced, and that these spirits in the disembodied state attracted, appropriated, digested, and assimilated elemental spirit and elemental matter whose condition was conformed to their own. Well, it's a bit of a word salad, but actually the concept is not that difficult. Here's Henry Pratt's New Aspect of Life and Religion, originally published in 1886. This footnote gives insights into why soul and body normally stay aligned and why under certain circumstances it's possible for them to separate. in the context of this footnote, spirit means the dweller in the form, not the spirit or monadic aspect. So what we here learned is, for spirit to be able to enter and make use of matter, there has to be a correspondence and quality between the two. These qualities being determined by opacity and transparency. For example, a high transparent spirit requires refined high frequency matter to express itself, and vice versa. So if a person pursues a path of extreme, quote unquote, physical depravity, they are actively increasing their opacity and density, which can, in extreme cases, lead to a break with their soul because the quality of their vehicle no longer corresponds to the quality of the overshadowing spirit. So that's the concept introduced here. Any thoughts or questions about this? See, normally, the nature of the matter is the quality, the vibration of the matter is held in the permanent atoms of a human being. And that would, that creates the quality of matter of the vehicles during incarnation that the spirit occupies. And so there's a natural linking of, you know, what he calls opacity and density, you know, between the vehicles manufactured or created in accordance with the information in the permanent atoms and the indwelling spirit, which is the soul on its own plane, right? Ariane, did you have a question?
Yeah, it's just quickly. I thought that there were supposedly a lot of soulless beings and that they often predominate in powerful positions. I know that sounds very cliche what I'm saying, but actually, you know, that they appear like everyone else, right? They might be in one's family even, but that they that they're very ambitious and that they have no moral rectitude. I'm just wondering when he says one out of 1,000, we have 8 billion people. I just wonder how rare it is.
Well, that was his teaching. I have no way of verifying that. But what he did, what Casey says about it is that they're not malevolent. They're, you know, for instance, it's not the evil people of the world. That it, becoming evil requires a choice of, and this is all Casey, of a choice to turn against the soul, to move a counter to the soul's intentions. Whereas the soulless ones are more of a blank slate, and they can have functional lives, and you know, they are the thing that Casey said about them that really set them apart was that they lacked creativity, that they could emulate creativity, but that they lacked it within themselves because that comes from the spark of the soul. But he really made a point of saying that, you know, they are not, they don't make up the ranks of the evil ones. However, they could be taken advantage of by, you know, the Black Lodge, et cetera. But, you know, there's not all that much information. There's
it was written before drugs came into effect, so all the kinds of addictions, you can see that, I mean, more or less everyone has some addictions, more or less, but that addictions can really derail one's evolutionary trajectory and could turn something very, very awry even at death, as people, you know, develop habits that they can't overcome.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think in extreme cases, you know, maybe something like what he's describing here could happen, that there could be such a different quality that would arise in the lower vehicles as a result of some particular form of addiction, that the soul would break off contact. But I think there's, I think that's rare. I think there would have to be a, it would have to be a hugely disparate level of opacity before that would happen. Much more likely is that, you know, after death, there would be the karma accrued, which would demonstrate in future lives, and then corrections made through the nature of the vehicles, the opportunities presented, and the astrology of the new incarnation. But, you know, that's just a guess on my part. And we are out of time. We'll pick up here on the second part of the footnote next time. Let's see, do you have any announcements, VL, for dates, etc.? Is she still here? BL, are you in the world? I see you.
Sorry. I just wondered if you wanted to go to Anissa before we wrap it up. I do have the dates.
Well, sure. Anissa, did you have your hand up? I'm sorry.
Yeah. I have a shirt tail relative who I was, you know, just wound up talking to on the phone about a year ago. And we were talking about meditation. And I was encouraging this individual to meditate. And what came back at me was that they had tried that, but they have no ability to imagine, that there was no imaginative quality. Like they couldn't imagine you know, a ball of light, you know, or moving around, or a beam of light, or, you know, that they, yeah. And the only thing I could think of was, well, put your hand there, but you're talking. And I wonder if this is the kind, if this would be a kind of individual without a creative, you know, because she just said, well, I don't have a visual, the ability to visualize. I think that's what it was. She doesn't have the ability to visualize things.
Yeah, well, you know, the flip.
I can't imagine not being able to visualize.
Yeah, you know, I was in a workshop with Robert Bly when I was in my 20s. You know, he was talking about metaphors, and I said, I don't know what a metaphor is. I can't even imagine what a metaphor is like, right? And now I live and breathe the world of analogies and metaphors, etc. So it could just be you know, a stage of the lack of development in this particular lifetime, this inability to imagine, though, you know, it does seem extreme. Flip part of me wants to say, take her to the doctor and have her check to see if she's soulless or not, but I don't think that would be an appropriate thing to say. Sorry about that. I don't think you can take one quality like that and make a determination. You would have to really spend time with her and extend your intuition to see, you know, how they felt. The one of the things Casey said is that there's a light in people's eyes that show the presence of soul, and that this light is not there, right? That's really all I can say. It could be a lack of a developed imagination rather than the inability to imagine, you know. So at any rate, interesting, isn't it? Idea. this whole concept of soulless beings. Anybody else? Okay, BL.
That's all I see right now. All right. So let me see if I can get this right this time. The next TCF is on the 27th of February. And the next Light of the Soul will be 1 March at 8 p.m. And then the next Secret Doctrine will be 15 March, and that's going to be 7 p.m. because the U.S. goes back to daylight savings time.
Okay, so, right. That Treatise on Cosmic Fire and Light of the Soul are on the same weekend. That's Friday and Sunday of the same weekend, 2 weeks from now. And yeah, that's it. Thanks so much, y'all, for attending today. I really appreciate that you are here and are interested. So much love. Take care. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.